What's up, Open Floor Globe? This is Ben Golliver of the Washington Post. I am joined on the other line by Michael the Pod Pina of Sports Illustrated. Now, Michael, we spent all of earlier this week trying to beg for teams to make trades, and we actually got a couple. We did. The Miami Heat acquired Trevor Ariza from the Oklahoma City Thunder, and the Milwaukee Bucks landed PJ Tucker, one of the guys that we had circled as potentially a trade deadline mover, from the Houston Rockets in kind of a convoluted package of picks. So let's start with the PJ Tucker one, because I feel like that's the bigger deal. We had talked about his potential fit with a lot of Eastern Conference contenders, whether it's Philly, whether it's Brooklyn. Milwaukee kind of snuck up out of nowhere and snagged him. What do you think, Michael? Was this a win for Milwaukee, a win for Houston? And does this change the outlook for the Milwaukee Bucks as they look ahead? And they're going to try to win this Eastern Conference, man. They've got their eyes on the number one seed right now.
I mean, I like it for both sides. I mean, obviously, your first priority is to look at the Bucks because they're trying to win the title, so they're more relevant. And my initial reaction was just that, you know, now, I mean, I was pretty high on Milwaukee before this trade, but what I wanted to see from them was an additional player. Like, I felt like they were one guy away from being able to access the lineup that they really need to actually win the championship with Giannis at the five. And I think that this addition, I don't know if it gets them all the way there, but it gets them pretty close, depending on what you feel, how you feel about Dante DiVincenzo and Pat Connaughton. I still like PJ Tucker a lot. I know that his corner 3-point shooting numbers have been down this season. I think that that is a product of playing in a hopeless situation, not having James Harden as a teammate anymore, et cetera. His attempts will be wide open, as they used to be when he was shooting 40% and upwards of 40% from the corners a few years ago. He isn't the defender that he used to be, but the way I see it, he doesn't really need to be a top 10 defender in a lineup that has Middleton, Giannis, and Drew Holiday. Like, he just needs to be super solid, which he can definitely be. So I like it a lot for Milwaukee, and I also like it for Houston. Like, they get DJ Wilson, who, I mean, we haven't really seen a lot of him, but just looking at his body type and looking at the small samples of activity when he has been out of Coach Bud's doghouse, like, that's, I think, a useful prospect, or at least an intriguing one. And for a rebuilding team, getting him, flipping the basically they're flipping an early second round pick for a late first round pick. So Houston's going to likely have three first round picks potentially, you know, if they're really bad, as they if they continue to be really bad and they get some lottery luck, they'll have a top four pick as well. So I like it for both sides, man. I mean, it's pretty straightforward.
Yeah, so let me start from the Milwaukee side. I always like it when I kill a team's offseason. They wait 2 months and then they undo the offseason. It makes me personally feel smarter, Michael, because I really didn't like what the Milwaukee Bucks did before the season. And here they go, undoing a lot of it, right? I mean, that DJ Augustin 3 years, $21 million contract as the backup plan for Bogdan, it just felt like a scramble in that moment. They thought they were going to land Bogdan Bogdanovic in restricted free agency. It didn't work out. And then they were just randomly throwing money at just, you know, people who I didn't think really fit that well, and they weren't going to be playoff players. You look at both DJ Wilson and DJ Augustin from Milwaukee's standpoint. You're not going to be able to play those guys in the playoffs. And Bud already showed he didn't trust DJ Wilson in the playoffs, right? So PJ Tucker does, you know, pass that test. He will be out there in important moments. The lineup versatility point that you're mentioning is a really good one. When they take Lopez off, they weren't just one piece short. They were two pieces short. Now, when they had him on the court there, you could argue that maybe they're just one piece short. But they've kind of been that big three. And then, you know, where else is the help coming from this year? And when Holiday was out, there were some pretty dicey moments there, too. So I think that not only does Tucker help their defense, which has slipped from number one last year to number nine this year, but he definitely helps their lineup versatility, definitely helps their matchups in those smaller lineups. And they're going to have to go to those smaller lineups, especially against a team like Brooklyn or even Miami. I think they're going to be better off going small in that matchup as well. So that part I agree with you. I definitely like it from Milwaukee's side. Now, is there another move for them to make? Do they have to go find another backcourt ball handler? That's absolutely possible. That could be a buyout guy, minimum salary guy, whatever it might be. That could be the next domino. Now, from Houston's side, I think it's a little bit more complicated. So let's explain how these trade picks work. Basically, Milwaukee gets its 22 back. They have to send out their 23. So that's pretty even exchange there, except Houston is betting that Milwaukee will be worse in 2023 than they're going to be in 2022. I think that's a pretty safe bet. You just never know how guys are going to age, how free agency is going to take a toll on your roster here and there. So that part makes sense. It's a minor win to me from Houston's side. The draft pick trade this year, it sounds really good. You know, Houston's trading its second for Milwaukee's first, but there's really not going to be much of a difference there. Like, Milwaukee's probably going to land around 25, 26, 27, 28 in the first round, whereas, you know, Houston's pick was probably going to be like between 31 and 34. So you're only talking about maybe 10 draft slots at most. That's a helpful, but maybe not quite as much as I expected a player like PJ Tucker to go for. I think the real questionable part here is the cost of bringing back DJ Augustin's salary. Now, they do have a massive need for playmakers and ball handlers because John Wall's been injured, Victor Oladipo's a question mark, and everything else. But if their longer-term plan is like, yeah, we got DJ Augustin back as a player, that will not go well for you, Houston. And maybe if it's a tank strategy, that's what they want to do. So, you know, good luck to them. But I don't think I would have wanted to bring all that salary back, you know, going forward into future years if I was the Houston Rockets. What do you think?
Well, two things real quick. I want to just say about Tucker, one of the underrated factors in bringing him into a system that is kind of evolving into a more switch everything scheme is this guy was an integral part of arguably the best switch everything defense the NBA has ever seen. And his vocal presence on the floor will be humongous. Like, he's super smart, super active. I mean, a lot of the problems that Milwaukee has had trying to implement that strategy has been just based on miscommunication. It's not a physical thing. They have the bodies, they have the length. So I'm really interested to see how he impacts that that aspect of it and just getting everybody on the same page. And you can't really quantify that, but I think that that's probably something that was in Milwaukee's the front of Milwaukee's brain when they made this transaction. Real quick about DJ Augustin, I kind of think that they're going to try to flip him before the deadline. And I think that one of the reasons why you make this trade a week before the actual deadline is you're able to kind of gauge and see who is interested in DJ Augustin, who might be a contender, and maybe you can get, pick up a second for him, something like that, and get off the salary. Like, a team like the Clippers, I'm just spitballing here, a team that has been complaining for almost two full years about not having point guard depth, DJ Augustin, I think, would be really helpful there. I don't know if they'd be willing to take on that money, but that's just something to keep an eye on, I think, before the trade deadline.
That's a really good point. I mean, he has a smaller salary than some other guys that have been linked to them, whether it's like Kyle Lowry or Eric Bledsoe, so it maybe be a little bit easier to construct a deal. You know, at the same time, maybe you're getting what you pay for on that one a little bit too. I'm not sure how much he's going to help them. I guess we'd have to wait and see on that. You know, going back to Tucker's fit in Milwaukee, you know, I think it's a pretty clean fit on the offensive end too. Look, all he wants to do is stand in that corner and shoot threes that are set up for him by his teammates. Milwaukee not only has a lot of drive and kick three opportunities with Giannis creating them, and he's proven to be a pretty quality passer in those situations. Giannis doesn't have the most incredible creative vision, but he does hit his shooters pretty well on target, you know, quite a bit. And it's been a consistent thing now here for 3 years where they have really, really good team offenses, in large part because he's doing a lot of drive and kick stuff. Now, this year they've mixed it up a little bit more, so it's less predictable from their offensive setup. But still, Giannis is going to get downhill a lot over the course of a game. Tucker's going to be ready, willing, and able to shoot those threes. I would expect his three-point percentage to bounce up from where it was, you know, since Harden left, because they just didn't have people generating as good of looks. And frankly, he wasn't as bought in personally in Houston here the last, you know, month and a half or so. And I also think they just moved the ball pretty well around the perimeter, whether it's Middleton, Holiday. They turn good shots into great shots. You know, Tucker's going to be asked to kind of pay off some of those possessions. And I'm pretty optimistic he's going to be able to do that. Now, this entire PJ Tucker experience, so a couple of years ago, Michael, I coined this phrase player tanking, which is basically like when a guy's not happy, he just, you know, mails it in pretty hard. I think James Harden is the greatest recent example of player tanking we've ever seen. I mean, he did it on the court. He did it off the court. He did it in the press conference. You know, he got himself fined. I mean, he really went all out to make sure everybody knew that he wasn't happy, and it worked out perfectly. But the key to player tanking is once you change locations, automatically your game immediately comes back and you're just like right back to where you were before you were upset, right? So Harden gave us the blueprint for that. Does Tucker have the same potential, or do we need to worry that maybe his best days are behind him? Because you make a really good point that in Milwaukee, he's not going to be asked to be like the lead defensive linchpin, right? Like last year against the Lakers in the second round, Houston was like, all right, well, James and Russ, they're going to handle all the offense, and PJ, you're just going to have to be the entire defense by yourself. And that did not go well for the Houston Rockets. That's not going to be the case here with Milwaukee, so they're going to be asking a little bit less of him. But I'm just wondering, like, you know, compared to his peak, and I would put his peak at maybe 2017, 2018, when you're combining physical tools, experience, you know, knowledge of opponent player tendencies and all that, how much does Tucker have left?
It's a great question. I mean, this is someone who, he's not young. He's got a lot of miles on the odometer, particularly since he went to Houston because he never missed any games. So I know there's been a little bit of talk, or at least I heard on one of the broadcasts last night about how he's been not really playing this season, so he could have some leftover in the tank. And I don't know about that. I think that there might be a correlation between how he's looked this season and how many minutes he's played over the past three seasons. But I also buy into everything that you're saying about the player tank. Like, he's going to be rejuvenated. He just is. Like, he's one of the grimiest, most, like, scrappy players in the entire NBA. He's in a position now where he can win a championship, something he has never done. And I don't think he's going to be in the starting lineup, but I do think he's going to be in closing lineups. I think his minutes will be severely reduced. I think he'll have a lot of energy in the second half of these playoff games when Milwaukee really needs a boost. And he doesn't have to do anything on the offensive end. Like, literally, they grab the defensive rebound, he runs to the corner. Like, that's what he's going to do on every possession. So I don't think he'll be expending too much energy in that regard either. I think it's just such a good fit. And, like, honestly, I'm really interested to know what the Nets thought when they saw this, because the Nets should be jealous, frankly. Like, I was high on the Blake Griffin edition, but like PJ Tucker is like he's the ideal guy who can plug into a team with stars. So
well, not only that Michael, it's sort of like a spy movie. I mean, I look at PJ Tucker, he's sort of like the diplomat who knows a lot about the target that maybe the spy agency is looking at, right? When they're getting ready for that Eastern Conference Finals against Brooklyn and they're writing up the scouting report about how to limit James Harden in the playoffs, who do you think is helping draft that thing? They're going straight to PJ and saying, hey, give us everything you've got, right? So I liked it that way for sure. It's a double win. I think he would have fit in Philly. I think he would have fit in Brooklyn. He would have fit a lot of places. And for Milwaukee to be able to get it at a relatively modest cost, get off some bad money and undo a mistake with the Augustin deal and plug him in and take your shot, I think it makes sense. Also, philosophically, look, they told Giannis, you know, we're going for it. They went out there and made that big deal to land Holiday. It was very risky. They've got to convince, you know, Holiday to re-sign. So there is some potential. Look, if PJ helps them make a deep playoff run, if they do get over the hump and get into the finals, then now everybody's happy. It's hunky-dory, and you're probably going to have a better shot at bringing Holiday back, and maybe you're even bringing Tucker back, and you've got yourself a group or a small core group here in the short term, you know, not a five-year core. You know, from Tucker's perspective, that can kind of go forward together. I think that would be the best case scenario. And so you don't want to go all in, but only go halfway in. And I think that this step helps him go further in, and it sends the message to Giannis and Holiday, look, you know, we're serious about this. We want to do it. So I'm going to ask you, though, are they going to accomplish it? Because right now, Milwaukee's red hot. Now, that game against Philly pretty ugly late in that game. A lot of mistakes both ways. A lot of stuff in that late game scenarios that I just really, you know, was ripping my hair out about. You got Chris Middleton throwing these alley-oops to Giannis like with a minute left in the game that's like flying over his hand for absolutely no reason. I mean, just go right down the list. A lot of careless turnovers and defensive mistakes from Dante DiVincenzo, leaving guys just wide open. Philly couldn't take a foul when they needed to take a foul. Middleton winds up just, you know, instead of dribbling the clock out, he just takes a layup, which set up Philly for one final chance to tie it. It's just a very messy endgame. The broadcasters kept saying it felt like a playoff game, and I kept saying, I hope not, because we need to do a little bit better than this during the playoffs. But, you know, they did pull out the victory, Milwaukee did, and they've been, you know, like I said, red hot here for the last couple of weeks. Are they in a situation where Brooklyn still doesn't have KD back? That one's dragging. And Bede's going to be out for a while for Philadelphia. Like, is this Milwaukee's conference to be the number one seed after we didn't really talk about them for the first 2 months of the season? Are they about to storm back and take this thing?
First of all, watching that game, I made the mistake of watching the first half, which was just, that was a slog. That was some of the worst basketball I've seen all season. Not fun. I do not recommend going back and watching that if anyone's missed it.
What did Milwaukee have at halftime? Like 16 points?
14 points, I think. It was.
Okay.
But before I get into answering your question, Ben, I have a fake trade for you that I want to run by. And I feel like this is a safe space and it's relevant to our discussion. And it kind of leads us to just the conversation about, is Milwaukee good enough as currently constructed, or is there another move that they can possibly make? So,
let me guess, Middleton for Tatum.
That's such a blasphemous thing to say to me.
I thought you said it was a safe space, Michael.
No, it's not for that. That talk is, that's wrong of you. No, but I think you'll like this. Okay. Dante DiVincenzo and Brooke Lopez to the Washington
already.
Wizards.
Yes, 100%. Sounds great.
To the Washington Wizards for Davis Bertans.
Well, I can't do it. Davis Bertans to me, sorry, no, like the payoff was not what I was expecting. I guess I should have been tipped off when you said Washington Wizards. And yeah, not a lot there you're going to be able to grab with Dante DiVincenzo and Brooke Lopez. I think you need the big body to match up with Embiid, you know, from Lopez's standpoint. Like, going Giannis at the five or Portis or whoever else, like, that's a real tough one. And then I really don't want to understate how bad Bertans' contract is. Like, this guy is the classic one-trick pony. What he does is helpful, but it's not so helpful that you want to be paying him through the next presidential election cycle. So I can't do it. I would prefer to just roll with Dante and Lopez. But I like the idea of trying to upgrade from those guys. But that's kind of one of the reasons why I like this Tucker trade. I didn't view Milwaukee as having very many trade assets. For them to get a player like Tucker, even if he's not as good as he was 2 years ago, with their very limited, you know, palette of tradable pieces, I thought was fairly impressive.
Yeah, I mostly threw that out there because, like, I get what you're saying about the contract, but, like, if you're Milwaukee, you just are never in a position where cap space really matters, right? So I don't really think it would be that much of a hindrance. And then, you know, Davis Bertans has been hitting the three ball finally recently, doing what he was paid to do. So that's, I just think like him in that spot would be really interesting, and you reunite the Lopez twins. But you make a really good point about needing size for an Embiid matchup for sure.
Well, let me ask you this. With Bertans, how many minutes do you think he could play in the playoffs? Because like he is like the ultra space creator, the quick trigger 3-point shooter. Like if you need to get into a run, like you can easily imagine a situation where Milwaukee is like in a first round series. They usually play Orlando in the first round and the score, you know, it's like 162 to like 14 at halftime. But you can easily imagine a scenario in that type of playoff series where Bertans is just gunning threes in transition. They're putting together some like 20-2 run. Everybody's super excited. I guess before the pandemic, Pfizer form is going nuts. I start to think like, okay, Eastern Conference Finals chess match. Who the heck is Bertans guarding on Brooklyn? Is he just going to get picked on? Is the obviously
they're hunting him?
Yeah, he's the weakest link. how many minutes can you even get from him in a real playoff series, which is part of the reason why I was questioning the size of the contract when Washington gave it out. I mean, they have bigger problems. They need to get to the playoffs first before they can worry about the matchup stuff. But I just think, you know, his combination of one-way play, not really doing much off the dribble at all, so just kind of that one-trick pony style, and that contract makes him pretty tough to move at this point.
Yeah, I didn't want to derail our conversation here and make this a diatribe about Davis Bertans, but
yeah, I really did that, by the way. This is really laying it on a really thick. My bad. So yeah, let's get back to what you think about Milwaukee in terms of the Eastern Conference standings.
Yeah, I mean, I think the Nets are going to win the East. Just they're not losing games, and Harden is like the. I don't think Harden's going to win MVP, but like his peak right now is just higher. Like his peak impact is higher than any other player in the league right now. I think that that's fair to say. Like he's just murdering everyone.
Let me just say on that point really quickly, Michael, if they give Harden the MVP over LeBron James, all of those little snide comments LeBron makes usually like 8 years after the fact of like, oh, Marcus Saul's got like a defensive player of the year award that should have been mine. I'm pretty sure those will come out in full force. Like you can only push a man so far. If you have Harden with the first month of the season that he had against LeBron, you know, coming off of the bubble, playing almost every single night, leading the Lakers to a great record. And if somehow Harden were to be rewarded over LeBron after LeBron already feels probably like he's been snubbed of 3 or 4 MVP awards, don't you think we could get an explosion from King James, like a real 5 minute long, what are we valuing about basketball in these conversations? Why do I keep getting overlooked? You've got to be kidding me. Who's doing it the right way? Can you see the picture that I'm painting here of the outrage from LeBron if this is how it was going to play out?
Oh, 100%. I mean, he's going on Instagram Live the second Woj tweets that Harden won the MVP. Like, that's no doubt about it.
Should we be rooting for this now?
I'm not rooting for Harden to win MVP. I'm sorry. I can't go that far, but I am rooting for all. General chaos is a fun thing in the NBA when it comes to this stuff. But getting back to our topic of discussion here, I think that the Nets are going to, I think that they're going to be the one seed in the East. They don't even have KD yet when he returns. I just don't know. Like this team is, the playoffs are a different beast than the regular season, but this team is just set up to just steamroll the regular season. And like they're in a rhythm. Everybody's comfortable with one another. They're trying on defense. I don't necessarily think that that means they'll win 4 straight playoff series, but for the sake of just kind of random basketball games, which is what the regular season is, like they have just too much talent on a night-to-night basis. And they don't even need, like last night they beat the Indiana Pacers. Kyrie didn't even play. And Harden just goes off. He has like a 40-point triple-double or whatever it was. Like this team is very, very good. But for the playoffs, I think that that's a different animal, and I think that I'm more bullish, far more bullish on Milwaukee getting to the finals than I was before this PJ Tucker trade, and I still had Milwaukee going to the finals as my pick.
Wow.
Out of the East before that.
Interesting. So I might actually be the exact opposite. I think that, you know, for Milwaukee, if they can continue this momentum, and it's been a little bit of up and down. There was like a 5-game winning streak, 5-game losing streak, 5-game winning streak stretch in there a little bit recently, which you don't really like to see that. But I think that the door is kind of open for them right now. They seem much better and together than they were earlier this season. Giannis seems like he's in a great headspace where he's having a lot of fun every night. He was trolling the Sixers fans last night. And
glorious.
It's coming very easily for him. I mean, I do wonder with Brooklyn, okay, is there going to be any acclimation process when they bring KD back? And then are they going to rest their guys at any point? And if Harden does miss time, they're going to be way up a creek. So I think we're going to have a really fun regular season race here for the number one seed. I think it's quite possible Milwaukee wins it. I just wouldn't count them out. But then in the playoffs, I feel like it's going to be Brooklyn's conference to lose. And I just wonder, like, how do you match up with them? I think it's just going to look differently. You know, some of those Eastern Conference, series last year, they just kind of got into slugfest a little bit, you know, where it's just like, all right, last team standing. And Brooklyn just scores so much more easily than any of the teams that were in last year's playoff field, at least where they were at the time during the playoffs. You know, Milwaukee had an amazing offensive efficiency in the regular season. It just came back to earth during the playoffs. So I almost flip it. I almost say, look, watch out for Milwaukee in the regular season and then watch out for the Nets in the playoffs. But we'll see how that one plays out. I want to read you one question here on the other side of this trade real quick, Michael. I know we're dwelling on this PJ Tucker trade, but look, we're thirsty. We're desperate. We want more moves. This is the incentive to all the GMs. If you make a trade here in the next week or so, we'll spend an hour and a half on it. Joel says, let's revisit that James Harden trade from Houston. I should have asked this when it happened because it looks like revisionist thinking now, but even at the time, I was floored that the trade included Houston not keeping Caris LeVert and instead including a third team so they could get Victor Oladipo. Am I missing something? I hated it at the time and still do. Oladipo was lucky to play one out of every three games, and he hasn't been relevant for almost 3 years. LeVert is clearly on the rise despite that random health scare during the trade. So he raises a good point, Michael. It was kind of confusing at the time. Now that we've had 2 months to digest it, what do you make of Houston's role there in that Harden trade? Because now they've also lost Tucker. All the other wheels have fallen off. I think the vision of, hey, we're going to have this wow core of John Wall, Oladipo, and Christian Wood, that, you know, wow, that didn't happen. And, you know, Cousins is already gone. Stephen Silas is America's number one sympathy figure. You know, I can't go 5 minutes on Twitter without seeing someone be like, man, I feel bad for Stephen Silas. So that's got to get pretty old from his standpoint. But what do you think? Like, did they just botch this thing? Should they have just taken LeVert?
I think it was very interesting. I thought it was very interesting in the moment that they didn't just take Caris LeVert, who is very good. And I recently wrote a thing about how, we're kind of sleeping on the Pacers. And when they're healthy with Caris, with TJ Warren, like, they're going to be a pretty damn good team, assuming they make the playoffs.
You know who's sleeping on the Pacers, Michael? The Pacers themselves, okay? They need to step it up. I don't know. They need, like, a motivational speaker or something like that. I mean, these guys just melt down in some of these games. And I get that they need the wing playmaker they've been missing since the Oladipo thing. Hopefully, Caris gets, like, the full ability to shine in that role. Mm-hmm. But I've been a little bit disappointed in that group. I got to say, they got my hopes up early. They really did.
No, they've been terrible since the Harden / Oladipo trade, and understandably so. And they've suffered some other injuries. And if you just look at, like, who's been in their starting lineup over that stretch, it's understandable that they've been bad. But getting back to the question about Caris versus Oladipo, I mean, we can't judge this until the trade deadline passes and we see if Houston is able to kind of squeeze assets out of Oladipo for a team that's interested in either getting his bird rights or just renting him for the rest of the season and seeing if he can push them over the top or help them make a lengthy, respectable playoff run. So if you can get valuable, I don't know, I really don't know what Oladipo's value is. He's putting up numbers, pretty impressive numbers, just like basic stats, but the inefficiency is a killer. So I don't know if there's a team out there that looks at him, sees the athleticism, sees the burst, sees the first step, and is selling themselves on, hey, like, he won't be as inefficient when surrounded by better teammates, and that is a fair point. He was a pretty efficient player with the Pacers before the trade. So that's kind of where I land with it. So if the calculus was we're going to be able to flip Oladipo, which maybe that wasn't entirely the motivation because they did technically offer him the 2-year extension, the $45 million extension. But, you know, I can't see Houston re-signing Oladipo to whatever figure he thinks he's worth, or whatever figure another team is willing to give. It's just like this team should be rebuilding. And even with a bunch of draft picks for the future that kind of allow you to play two timelines, I think they're like using their cap space in other ways as maybe a dumping ground, maybe just, you know, getting creative, trying to sign figures like Christian Wood, and going that route in the rebuild might be wiser than just kind of retaining Oladipo. But it was curious in the moment for sure that they took him over LeVert, who is probably a better basketball player.
Yeah, Joel, I think the answer here is it was the escape hatch, right? Like, if everything really went poorly, and there was reason for them to worry about things going poorly because Harden had been the entire organization for years and years and years, taking Oladipo, knowing that he was on the expiring contract, knowing that you could just get completely off of salary heading into the summer because you were going to be stuck with that John Wall contract for a while, has some real benefits to it, right? It just gives you a level of flexibility that you wouldn't have had otherwise, and Caris LeVert would have been on your books there for a while, and there was, you know, it wasn't clear to me whether he was going to be a great fit there or not. And so things have gone about as poorly as they possibly could go, right on schedule. And so to me, this could turn out to either a trade like Michael's describing, or potentially just, you know, you part ways this summer and you just would prefer to have cap space, prefer to be in a you know, more of a cost-cutting rebuild mode. And for a new GM, that's what they want. They want that flexibility. You know, I don't think that they would have handled this trade the same way had the GM who was in the spot been the same guy who was there for the previous years, right? I think that sometimes guys come in, they have a new vision for how they want to do things. They want to have the ability to construct a roster to their own specifications. And I think that was part of the allure of this particular trade. But look, Oladipo also hasn't been as good as I'm sure they hoped, right? Like, I think that their best case scenario was he comes in and looks like a franchise level player. Then they do pay him, and then they've got themselves a nice core. And that just didn't work out. I personally probably wouldn't have made that bet, but I can see why maybe in a point of desperation where James Harden is completely hanging them out to dry, they could have talked themselves into that. All right, Michael, here real quickly on the Trevor Ariza trade that I mentioned earlier. So Oklahoma City sends him to Miami for Myers Leonard and a second round pick. I've never seen a louder collection of media voices screaming, "Don't worry, Oklahoma City doesn't want Myers Leonard the player. They only want the contract," you know, to kind of tamp down all the you know, the frustration around Myers Leonard's recent comments. I mean, this was always going to be a possibility for Myers Leonard getting traded because he was injured, because he was on a very flexible contract. I don't think the situation, you know, the off-court thing with the video game and his anti-Semitic comment had anything to do necessarily with him being involved in this trade. But I do think it will determine his future going forward with Oklahoma City, where I don't ever see him taking the court for the Thunder. And, you know, he may very well be traded or bought out here over the next week or two. From Miami's standpoint, is Trevor Ariza worth a future second-round pick, a 2027 second-round pick? Can Ariza hold up in the kinds of playoff matchups that we were talking about earlier with some of these players who we didn't think that they could? You know, he's going to have to get some time, you would think, on Brooklyn's wings, right? He would have to get some time on Milwaukee's wings, potentially, in a playoff series. Is he capable of doing that? He didn't play in the bubble last year for personal reasons, you know, family reasons, and he really hasn't played all year because Oklahoma City's just had him sitting there on ice waiting to trade him.
Yeah, I mean, who knows what Trevor Ariza looks like? He will be more useful than Myers Leonard. He's 35, but as you said, he didn't play in the bubble last year. He did make 40% of his threes for Portland in about 20 games. So that's good to see, you know, if you're Miami. I don't know, you know, this could be a Jay Crowder situation for them, or it could be a Mo Harkless situation for them. It's kind of an in-between for me. Like, is he going to crack the rotation? Is he going to find a definitive role? That's to be seen. Miami is pretty unpredictable with their rotation and just kind of their view on guys in-house and who works and who doesn't. So, I mean, I think generally it's just like it's a good piece of business for them. Like, they're trying to win now. This is a win now player, ostensibly. We'll see. And Myers Leonard damn sure had no future there. So, makes sense.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, look, it's a very low cost and low risk, low reward probably. But if he gives you anything, it's worth doing. I don't think it's going to be the same combined impact as that Crowder-Iguodala move from last year where, you know, I didn't even think that was going to be that big of a deal. And it wound up actually really helping power that that playoff run. So that would probably be an unfair standard. But if he gives you anything, it counts as a win because the cost was, you know, absolutely nominal. All right, Michael, I want to shift gears to a topic that I was writing about this week. You know, the NCAA tournament opens on Thursday. We're in a situation where, you know, obviously they're in a bubble. You have some other high-level players, two of the top five prospects in the 2021 draft who are playing for the G League Ignite in a different bubble, right? They've been playing there all year as part of this new program where, you know, guys from high school can go straight to the G League, get paid not NBA level salaries, but meaningful salaries, and then become draft eligible the following year. So we are in a situation where, you know, it's just looking different, right? When you're starting to look at this NCAA bracket, if you're an NBA fan, you're saying, okay, well, the number one overall pick that everybody expects is Cade Cunningham, this big two-way, you know, 6'8" guy, lead ball handler, very creative, off the dribble, polished scorer, can really, you know, potentially step in as a rookie and lead an offense. You've got Evan Mobley, a center for USC. I think a lot of people see as the number two prospect, where he pencils out as a two-way center, you know, shot blocking, very versatile, step out and switch, interesting offensive game. And then you've got Jalen Suggs, you know, another guard for Gonzaga, where they're undefeated. They're going to probably be the favorite to win the whole thing. He's been sensational as a freshman and is probably even better than his numbers look because he's playing on a very good and balanced roster. And I think people see him stepping in as potentially a lead ball handler pretty early in his pro career as well. I think the most fascinating question for us, Michael, because I know you and I don't exactly break down the tape like a Jay Billis for, you know, 30 hours a week from the college standpoint, is that four of the top five players in this year's class are perimeter players, playmakers in that vein. And Mobley is the exception. He's like the 7-foot center where he's seen as modern. He's seen as versatile. He's seen as a potential two-way impact level player. And I'm just curious, when you're looking back at, say, like the last five drafts, and I tend to check in on this particular question just about every year, but when you're looking back at the last five drafts, where do you think the relative value of the big man has gone and where is it trending? And like, how good does a big have to be for you, if you're a GM, to be willing to invest like a top two or a top three pick in there? Because if we're looking back and saying who's really making instant impact here over the last couple of drafts in the NBA, it's pretty much all been the guards or guys who have been, you know, starting to play like guards, with a Zion Williamson where he's almost like this big point forward, right? Would you be able to talk yourself into taking a 7-foot center with a top two pick this year?
I mean, I think generally it would matter just how my roster was constructed. Like, centers are, they're just harder to fit into what has previously existed on a roster. So it's not like you can just kind of, they're not plug and play assets or contributors along the lines of, you know, a wing or a big ball handler, or, you know, an Anthony Edwards, a LaMelo Ball, a Patrick Williams. Those kind of guys, I feel like, are just a little easier to just fit into a general bad team's roster. And usually, you know, bad teams are the ones that are picking up high. I mean, if the 7-footer was just a total beast, like, projected out to be someone you could really leverage like post moves with, and who can rebound and who had outside touch and was smart and could pass from the high post and was just this physical monster like Joel Embiid, or I mean, you're not finding a Nikola Jokic ever again, so I'm not even gonna bring him into this conversation. But if that type of piece was available, then I would go for it. Like, I understood the attraction to James Wiseman for Golden State. Now, some of that was due to fit, and I'm sure that's why they needed a big. That's why they took him. They already have the Splash Brothers. They have Draymond, et cetera. Like, LaMelo overlapped a little bit more with what they already had there. So it's kind of like it needs to be just the right situation, right? Like, if I'm looking at the teams that are picking right now, like Minnesota, if they get the number one pick, I doubt they're taking a big, right? Like, Orlando, probably not taking a big. But then you have like Sacramento, they could take a big. Toronto, if they were to land the number one pick, would take a big. Washington would take a big. So there are teams out there, I think, that would be intrigued by size and what the big man can bring. And I don't really know Evan Mobley's game down. I don't have it down to a T. I have actually never seen him play basketball. I'm going to be upfront with that. But if he's a little bit more than, you know, a DeAndre Jordan-esque rim running rebounding, rim protecting big, and he can bring value in other areas of the game, then sure, like size will always be in style.
Yeah, it's interesting. I'm wondering, like, I mean, we've got a pretty long track record here of guys, big guys, who got up a lot of attention in the pre-draft run-up, and then now we're sitting around asking, well, when are they going to become huge impact-making players in terms of wins and losses, right? Like, I point to DeAndre Ayton. I would point to, obviously, Marvin Bagley. I think James Wiseman is an interesting one. And there were always arguments in those years, like, why are you going to be drafting a big? Like, it makes no sense. The NBA is kind of going away from them. And kind of time after time here, we're seeing, I mean, obviously, Luka over Ayton and Luka over Bagley is just comical, right? I think there's a pretty strong argument developing LaMelo over James Wiseman is looking pretty darn good too. And I also, like you, was willing to give Wiseman the benefit of the doubt. And I certainly don't want to write him off after a year where he's not really being used to his full potential. I don't think in Golden State the fit is kind of strange, right? But I'm just wondering, like, is there like a Captain Obvious answer here, which is like, no, you'd be an idiot to draft a big almost no matter who it is, unless you're getting Anthony Davis. Like, what is the potential payoff? And you even go back and look at a Karl Anthony Towns, a number one pick, a guy we were all gushing over for years and years. Has that translated to success for Minnesota, or have they spent their last 3 years trying to find a lead guard to pair with Karl Anthony Towns? Had they, in a different, you know, alternate universe, been able to build around a lead guard, would they have gotten to a more productive team dynamic more quickly than they did trying to build around a center? I think it's a fair question. So I think the number one thing I'm looking for over the next month or so of college basketball games as they kind of, you know, get through this tournament is, can Evan Mobley for USC show me enough to convince me that, like, all of this positional baggage that's been, you know, going around here for the last 3 or 4 years, like, he's an exception to it, right? Like, there's something about him. He's so complete. He's so tantalizing on offense that you almost have to, like, set him aside from this pack because, I do think this, the way the game is being played, how many three-pointers are going up? I mean, you could even frame this a different way. How good does a player have to be a top draft pick if he's a non-shooter, right? If you're getting off-the-dribble shooters with Jalen Suggs and a Cade Cunningham, both those guys are comfortable shooting the three-point ball off the dribble. And that's what we're saying from all different players, from Damian Lillard to Jason Tatum, as being like the most valuable offensive skill. Like, if your centers, you know, DeAndre Ayton is never going to be an off-the-dribble three-point shooter. It's unfair to even ask that of him. Probably going to be pretty difficult to ask that of Evan Mobley as well. If they're not fitting, you know, the stylistically where this game is at right now and where it's probably going, would it just be kind of an automatic mistake? And I don't love that. You know, I would like to think that all five positions are worth relatively equal value. But first of all, I'm not sure we still have five positions anymore in the modern game. And second of all, I think your replacement level big, you know, teams are getting by winning titles with replacement level or below replacement level centers and focusing all of their real resources and energy on the playmakers. And I just wonder, are we ever going to see that play out in the draft? Like, will there be 3 years down the road where, like, the first 9 picks of the draft are all playmakers or perimeter guys and the big guys are just, you know, bringing up the rear?
Yeah, I think the deal breaker question you're asking is really interesting. Like, if a big can't shoot or a player can't shoot, does that really hurt their value in a draft? And when I look at bigs, the deal breaker question for me is pick and roll defense. Like, how many different types of pick and roll defense are you able to execute at an extremely high level? Can you drop and protect the rim? Can you be up to touch and then recover back to your man in time to avert a pull-up three from a Dame Lillard or a Steph Curry? Can you switch on the perimeter and move your feet and stick with a wing, stick with a Luka or a Tatum or whoever, and do your best to shut them down or make their life really difficult, force them into a tough shot, not need help? Can you defend in the post? I mean, I think defense is really where you bring value if you're a big man. So if you can't do those things, then you're just not as useful to me. And that's why I thought that, the Onyeka Okongwu pick by the Hawks at number 6 was really fascinating because they already have Clint Capella. They have John Collins, who maybe they're trying to move. But picking him that early was fascinating to me because clearly he has a lot of value, I think more so on the defensive end and his mobility on that side of the ball than anything he can do with it. And that could serve like a lot of use for Atlanta as it kind of builds out around Trae Young. So I think, long story short, defense is really what I'm looking at if you're drafting a big man.
Yeah, for sure. And like, how dominant do they have to be? Do they have to average 5 blocks a shot like Anthony Davis did to justify that top of a, you know, high of a pick? Or, you know, what's the standard there? Because all things considered, if we're ranking the most important skills in basketball right now, like, offense has every benefit. You know, offense is probably more important, and playmakers have kind of won the day. You know, another comparison that we should probably be looking back at is Ja Morant versus Zion Williamson. Zion Williamson has defied basically everything that we know about the NBA, like, you know, the focus physics on three-pointers, physics too. Yeah, like, you know, just leading the league in paint points, you know, being an effective playmaker at his size. And yet, you know, stack up their team's records from these last couple of years, and Ja Morant's missed a lot of time. He hasn't had a ton of help in Memphis. You know, key players around him have been injured, and yet Memphis's track record is better in the win-loss column than the Pelicans' track record in these first couple of years. And New Orleans has tried to go out and target some pieces, you know, to put around Zion, and yet who's been more effective? There's a lot of different explanations for it, but it's just one more data point where you're saying, well, you know, if they would go back and have another chance, do you think Memphis would prefer to have Zion over Ja, or do you think they're okay with Ja? I kind of think they might be okay with Ja.
Okay, so this is, I get what you're saying, but it's ludicrous. Like, come on, man.
No, are you sure?
I like how Memphis has constructed their team. I think that they just make a lot more sense. I think it's an organizational issue when you're comparing the Pelicans' success with the Grizzlies' success, like straight up. So that's one thing. But like, and just, you know, style of play and the Memphis Grizzlies just make a lot more sense than.
Well, let me ask you though, do they make a lot more sense because they have a point guard who plays point guard instead of having a middle linebacker who plays point guard?
I would take blindly like Zion over, I don't even know how many players in the league. I guess like I would invert it and say, who would I not take over Zion? Ja Morant doesn't really come close on that.
No, it's tricky. Like, I love Zion too. There's no question about it, right? But you definitely have to make compromises and very strategic decisions to kind of put him in this situation that's optimum success for him and that will also translate to success for the team, right? There's just, it's a trickier fit. And, you know, is your goal to win 500? You want to go 500 in your first couple of years straight out of the draft? That's not your goal. Your long-term goal is to be able to build towards a title team. Does Zion have a higher ceiling? Could he lead a better team longer term than Ja Morant? I would still, you know, agree with that argument, but sometimes these GMs don't get to play with seven-year plans, right? Sometimes they're more focused on what's the next 3 years look like. And I think we've got a pretty strong body of evidence, which is like, you know, draft the playmaking guard. You're going to be better in the short term and just kind of figure out everything else from there. And it might actually be easier to build around those guys too.
I think, man, the uniqueness of there's really no one like Zion, obviously, in the league right now or ever before. And Ja also doesn't have too many parallels right now because, like, the undersized point guard who doesn't shoot threes yet is still – or, like, defend at an extremely high level, who still can get buckets when he wants and is just an absolute marvel playmaker and impacts winning. Like, those players are – I can't really think of too many, honestly. Like, he is such a throwback in his own right. But – as you were talking, I'm thinking about like how much, you know, we talk about Zion and Brandon Ingram as a duo, and you've tried to break them up for years now. but if you had Ja Morant and Brandon Ingram as teammates, like, do you think that that would stifle a little bit of like either player just because Ja needs the ball in his hands? Quite a bit. Ingram likes the ball in his hand. So I think it's just, again, it goes back to kind of roster construction and personnel and context. surrounding personnel.
Well, but what do you say? Like, I mean, Zion definitely needs to have the ball. He's installed there as the number one guy for sure. And Ja is an incredible passer and a very good orchestrator in the half court. I mean, he keeps people involved. He has a nice pace to him. He's able to, you know, drive and kick and get people set up for other opportunities. Like, I really do think he elevates the play of his teammates. It's not an accident they're winning games. I think he drives a lot of it. I want to put this one to the Memphis Grizzlies fans out there. Email us, openfloormail@gmail.com. Openfloormail@gmail.com. Would you trade Ja Morant right now for Zion Williamson, Michael? I'm going to bet you they say no, in part probably because of his personality and everything else. But it's a fair question. Look, if they don't want to trade him, like if they're not thirsty for the number one pick in that draft and they're okay with what they've got, that's an important data point here.
I think this is... you know, I listen to the 538 podcast a lot, and they ask, is this a good case of good use of polling or bad use of polling? This is a bad use of polling. You can't poll the Memphis Grizzlies fans and ask them if they'll trade their franchise player. That's just not how it works.
We could ask the New Orleans Pelicans fans, too. I just think, like, you're saying it's ludicrous, and I'm telling you, like, people who have a vested interest in the Grizzlies winning would probably make the argument that they're better off from a five-year perspective, a roster-building perspective, and everything else, just sticking with Ja. And I'm not saying that's going to carry the day, but I'm very curious what they would say. They might come back and say, heck no, we like watching Zion pulverize Enes Kanter on a night-to-night basis, so let's just stick with that. I could understand that too, but I don't think it's as one-sided as you're making it out. That's my point.
It is one-sided. I'm sorry that I'm being curmudgeonly here. Although I will say this has me fantasizing about a Zion Williamson, Jaren Jackson Jr. front court, and that duo would win like six straight championships. So if we get nothing out of this conversation, at least it's those images in my head.
So my last point to tie this off, drafting bigs, you understand it's going to take a little bit longer to develop them. If they really are the next Anthony Davis, then you have to worry that they're going to do the next Anthony Davis thing and try to position themselves out of town to try to, you know, get to a different market to go get a title, right? If they're not able to kind of lead that team themselves. And to me, that should be another factor here. Like, you can't guarantee for sure that you're going to have a franchise level big for 9 years anymore because, you know, the player empowerment movement. And so if the first three of those years are spent ramping up and getting into a situation where, you know, they're trying to become all NBA level players, whereas some of these guards like a Luka is just hitting the ground running as an all-star basically from day one, that's a different calculation too. And so, you know, with Zion, it's been great to see him as a big guy having a pretty instant impact, both in his rookie year and now especially in his second season. So his timeline's a little bit accelerated, but most bigs don't go that way. Think about how long it took Bam Adebayo to develop, you know, a couple of years to really ramp up. Had he not already been in a destination market, right? That team that grabbed him is now thinking like, uh-oh, like how long until he becomes the next Anthony Davis? So it's one more thing you've got to weigh here when you're looking at this decision to draft the big guy. I'm not trying to scare every single person off of Evan Mobley. That's not my intention. I just do think whoever takes him is bringing on more risks than you might actually anticipate. All right, Michael, let's wrap this thing up with one question that came in from Jackson, and he was heated. I just finished watching the last 58 seconds of the Nets-Knicks game, which took about 20 minutes of real time to complete. The ability to use back-to-back timeouts without inbounding the ball is a questionable rule, and it caused the first long delay. Then the Knicks are called for a foul on a tie-up, which is subsequently challenged. It takes an eternity to review, but the call is eventually overturned. Jump ball, timeout. In a bit of cruel irony, the climactic moment of the game is actually quite anticlimactic as Julius Randle gets called for a travel, despite Kyrie Irving clearly touching the ball. No ability to review, game over. We can spend 6 minutes reviewing one call, but we can't spend 10 seconds to overturn an incorrect call. Ben, Michael, why is the NBA allowing this to happen? Why are we taking an eternity to review 50-50 calls, yet still missing obvious calls? The NBA is living in the double inefficient quadrant. Too much dead time and easily correctable calls still incorrect. Please get the word out that the NBA has a set of rules in place that make the most exciting part of the game borderline unwatchable. I'm not as angry as Julius Randle, but I'm steaming. So just one quick point of clarification to Jackson, who was clearly upset. He told us he wasn't angry, but he was angry. It sounds like they got that call right on the Julius Randle tip from Kyrie Irving, because Randle never actually lost control of the ball. The ball was touched, but he still had possession. So when he put it back down to dribble, he did basically commit a turnover. So I think the referees got the well actually one on that one and escaped a little bit of frustration probably, you know, from the press the next day, but certainly not from Randle, who had a gigantic meltdown on the court after that situation. Michael, what do you think of the NBA's endgame situations? Have you found yourself just, you know, pounding your head night after night like I have with how long some of these late game scenarios take to play out? I mean, Sixers, Bucks was another one that just took forever to play the last couple of minutes on Wednesday night. And what can they do to fix this?
Well, I mean, first of all, this is why I watch games. A vast majority of the games I watch are DVR'd, so I can fast forward through the dead ball reviews and the free throws and all of that. But it's truly terrible. And last night, I actually got caught watching it live with the Bucks Sixers game, and I was very unhappy with that. I mean, I don't really know how. What you want to do, they're trying to do, is get every call right, right? So that's the whole purpose of the review, the purpose of the challenge, the sub-2-minute automatic review. All that is because they want to get the most important possessions correct. So I see the value there, obviously, but then it at the same time disrupts the beauty of basketball, which is the jazzy flow. And the quick possession to possession action. For me, like, the worst calls, and this is what I don't understand and what I need, it needs to be rectified, in my opinion, is when a player is clearly fouled as the ball is going out of bounds, but then they can't review to see if he was in fact fouled, only who touched it last. Like, those are incomprehensible to me, and the fact that we're still doing that, it's just kind of embarrassing. But otherwise, like, I don't really know how to solve the issue aside from just, like, I mean, you have to make a sacrifice at some point. It's either the tempo of the game or getting the call right. Like, I don't know where you fall, like, right with that.
Yeah, I would say get rid of the coach's challenge. It's just another unnecessary layer. What about changing? Okay. No, just get rid of it. Look, they just recently added it. I don't think it's working. I think it's bogging everything down. I think there are enough reviews in key moments. I don't think that we need more. So just strip that one back. What about all timeouts in the last 2 minutes are just 20-second timeouts, right? Can we use that to speed things up a little bit? Can we cut down the number of timeouts that coaches have available to them in those situations? We don't need every play set up, you know, coming out of a timeout, you know, back and forth and back and forth. If you can't inbound the basketball and you're out of timeouts, tough luck. You should have been able to inbound the basketball. I have a little bit less sympathy in those situations. So to me, I would look at, you know, potentially, like, after a certain point of the game, look, this is prime time. This is when everyone's watching. We don't want, you know, 58 seconds to take 15 minutes to play out in real time. This is when the fan base is the most engaged. Let's put our best foot forward, you know, from the league's perspective, and you don't need full timeouts to draw plays. 20 seconds, boom, you know what you're going to do. All right, get back out there and do it. I would like to see them, you know, take some meaningful actions here, because you're always going to have some level of reviews in those situations. There's really no way to get around that. I don't want to see them, like, take out half of the reviewable situations, because I think that they've done a pretty good job of pinpointing the types of plays that should be reviewed. But I do think that you can look at game flow in some other ways, whether it's the timeout distribution or the length of timeouts, and also cut out the coach's challenge. I think that would be a step in the right direction. But I, unfortunately, Jackson, to our emailer, I don't see some panacea, some, like, sweeping plan that's going to turn basketball back into the beautiful game with no interruptions. I think, unfortunately, we're too far down that path, and we just need to kind of undo it here step by step. All right, Michael, I think we've reached the end of another episode of Open Floor. Guys, you can email us, openfloormail@gmail.com, openfloormail@gmail.com. Michael is on Instagram and Twitter, @MichaelVictorPina. I'm on Instagram, @Ben.Golliver, on Twitter, @BenGolliver. Be sure to go to Apple Podcasts and search for our show with the two words, Open Floor. When you find our page, scroll down. It will say rate and review. Tap 5 stars. It's just that easy to help us spread the word. Michael, we'll be back with regularly scheduled programming next week. Guys, if you didn't get a chance to check out the bonus episode this week with Jack McCallum, he dropped all sorts of insider knowledge about the 2008 USA basketball gold medal winning team, LeBron James, Kobe Bryant, what's it like to be a Hall of Fame voter and everything else. So be sure to check that one out. All right, Michael, until next week, I will talk to you.
Talk soon, Ben.